Hello, welcome again to the Christian Leaders Institute course, History 101, History of the World. And we're focusing on this section on the time period between 1000 and 1500 AD. Last time we looked at some of the major conquests that went on during that period of time, selecting those in particular that had some lasting significance for later developments. So we looked at the Norman conquest of England, we looked at the Turkish invasion of the Middle East and later on the Ottoman Empire, we looked at the Incas and the Aztecs, and today we'll enter into the Mongol conquest, which is probably the most significant of all of them, just in terms of its long-lasting effects and just the size of the conquest. And when we finish that, we'll go into the next topic, which is about the different ways the religions of the time period interacted. So we begin today with the Mongol conquest, and here's your reading assignment, the Mongol invasion and conquest, in the Wikipedia link. Make sure you read that. You don't have to know every detail in it, but to get a general idea of how the Mongols went about their warfare and some of their history and some of that story is what I'm looking for you to understand. So when we talk about the Mongols, the primary person we're talking about is Genghis Khan, who was born in 1162 and died in 1227. So the earlier part of our time period. Genghis Khan was the son of an aristocrat, a princely figure, but his parents were murdered, and he grew up as an orphan and in a very, very difficult childhood. One of the things that was really true of his culture, was that your family, it's very family-centered, clan-centered, and all the favors went to your clan members, whether they were capable of it or not, particularly in terms of leadership. And one of the things that Genghis Khan did, and he really changed that, and a lot of people attribute that to his growing up without a father and mother, is that he began to reward merit, people's accomplishments, their abilities, rather than birth as the road to achievement. As one author puts it, as he smashed the feudal system of aristocratic privilege and birth, he built a new and unique system based on individual merit, loyalty, and achievement. Now, this is mostly true. However, it is also the case that as time went on and after he died, it was his sons and his grandsons and his nephews and others who generally became leaders. So it's not exclusively true. But he shared the wealth of their conquest much more broadly. He didn't just award the aristocratic families, give them all the booty. He spread that out to his troops, and that was one of the reasons that they loved him so much. This is a portrait of Genghis Khan, and as you can see, he is clearly Asian descent, and he is from Mongolia. This is a picture of Mongolia, and you see as the map moves, you see the conquest of the Mongol Empire. But as we start out, we see that it's just basically there in northeastern China, Russia, Siberia, and that's where he begins. You see it, the empire spreads quite quickly. So a little bit about Genghis Khan. Around 1200, he's a clan warrior. His real name is Temenggen. Genghis Khan is actually a title. It's not his name. And before, the clans were not necessarily unified. They often fought against each other. They raided each other, stole things from each other. But around 1200, he began to unite them. And in 1206, he's awarded the title Genghis Khan, which meant universal leader. And he became recognized as the leader of all the Mongol tribes. Mongol culture is a nomadic culture. They didn't necessarily live in a city and expand from there. They had various places where they moved around. And it had everything to do with being a horse culture. The horse is the primary animal in the Mongol culture. And they would take their horses and such to new pasture lands, wherever they could find grazing. One of the things that they had that was a great to their advantage over other people is they learned how to laminate the bow. That is made of thin strips that are glued together. And it's estimated that their bow could probably shoot one-third farther than other people's bow at the time. You can imagine what a great advantage that is in their warfare. They grew up in a very harsh climate. They wore clothing made out of mostly horse skins and horse felt. One of the interesting little things about the Mongol culture is as they spread, people began to observe that the men, the warriors, didn't wear the tunics that everybody else wore, you know, sort of the kilts or the dresses that other people wore, but they wore leggings, pantaloons, trousers. And one of the lasting effects is that this trend spread throughout Europe. And the reason that many of us wear pants today is because the Mongols brought that from their horse culture in Mongolia. As I mentioned, they're a family clan based, and loyalty to family is the number one virtue. Their religion is amorphous, not very well defined. They're able to accept virtually any of the gods that the people whom they conquer worship. However, they themselves have a supreme deity who is the sky god, the eternal god, the great blue, and they do their worship of that chief deity. They grew up in the clans making raids on their neighboring peoples. They did that for revenge, primary driving motivation. You attack my brother, I'm going to attack you, sort of thing. And also to steal, to collect booty. And as I mentioned, the booty is shared under Genghis Khan, in distinction from previous leaders, is shared with all the troops, and that made him very popular among his warriors. One of the first things that they did was they attacked the Jurgen Jin Empire, which is a Chinese northeastern China, and the Jurgens were constantly harassing the Mongolian people, often oppressing them, making them slaves, capturing them. And Genghis Khan and the Mongolian warriors had had enough of this and began to attack them around 1215. So he begins this expansion out of Mongolia into Asia, and first of all, it goes against the Jurgens. This is a painting of a Mongolian warrior. You see the laminated bow, you see the trousers that he's wearing, the clothes that he's wearing. He's fierce, he's ruthless, known to be uncannily bloodthirsty. When they would attack an area, they would generally, first of all, send emissaries to say to a town or a city or a place, surrender and we'll let you go. Do not surrender and we'll wipe you out. Well, some places tried to resist them. None of those places stood, and indeed the Mongolian warriors wiped out men, women, children, animals. They would just devastate the town, level it, turn it into dust, they would say. Well, news soon spread of this is how these people operate. And to the next town, when the deal came, surrender or be annihilated, surrender was often the option. That's one reason they were able to spread so fast and so quickly. They didn't spend years and years and years and years attacking one town, and after they conquered that, moved to the next. They could move very quickly on their horses. They could move very quickly because many people surrendered to them ahead of time, and they came in as conquerors. This map demonstrates a number of the spread of the Mongolian Empire. I mostly at this point just would like you to observe here they began in Mongolia, and they first of all go to the Jurgen-Jen Empire, and they take control all the way to the sea. They never actually controlled Korea, the Korean Peninsula, but they came very close to it. And by 1215, they have control of this entire area. At that point, Genghis Khan turns his eyes westward and moves into the land of the Uyghurs, who become actually allies of his, and then into the Western Liao Empire and to Khwarezm. So within the span of a very short period of time, 10, 15 years, the Mongolian Empire spread here from Mongolia all the way to the sea and all the way actually to what we would call today Russia. That was during the time of Genghis Khan. So he dies around in 1217 or so. No, I'm sorry, he dies around 1227. So he's actively engaged in his warfare for about 25 years, 20 years more or less. And as I indicated, during that period of time, he expanded tremendously the empire all the way to Persia. It was really, this map again shows under Genghis Khan how far he went. So from his main site in Karakorum, he spread out here in just a few years. He goes south, down into the Himalayas, the northern Himalayas. He goes west, and all of Central Asia, all the way to the Caspian Sea. And in very significant ways, through raids, he challenges Kiev, which is where the Rus people lived, later Russians. And they were in control of this large area, Russian principalities. He threatens them tremendously, such that they have to move their capital from Kiev. Pretty soon they'll move it up to Moscow. So he himself led his armies, and his generals led his armies in a tremendous conquest in all of Central Asia. Following Genghis Khan, after he dies, his generals take over, and his sons and grandsons begin to take over. One of the more important battles that they have is the Battle of Baghdad. Baghdad is the center of power for most of the Middle East at this time, and if you capture Baghdad, now you've captured virtually all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. In 1258, they do capture Baghdad, and pretty well annihilate it and destroy the Islamic Caliphate at that time. As I mentioned, characteristic of Mongolian warfare, very mobile because of the horse. They do have lots of local infantry, but those are mostly people whom they take from the local population and impress into military service. One of the things that they did that others didn't do so much is they engaged in winter warfare. Most of the time, warfare was a summer event. And in the winter, you would store up your supplies, you would mend your wounds, you would make your weapons, you would prepare your battle plans, but no full attacks in winter, except the Mongols, who, of course, are from a very harsh climate, a very winter cold climate. They knew just how to do that in wintertime, and they surprised very many people that way. They were very adaptive. They're a nomadic culture, so they don't have a high degree of technology on their own. But as they observed others' technology, particularly the Chinese, when they captured the Jurgen-Jen, they noticed the use of, for instance, siege machines, and they built various kinds, and they took Chinese engineers with them as they went west. So that the Chinese engineers, they didn't drag all these machines, all these warfare machines with them, but when they would get there, if they needed them, they had the Chinese engineers who knew just how to build them. Again, their message was surrender or be destroyed. And it didn't take too long before most people understood that to surrender was the better of the two options. particularly in the early period of time, the Mongols were not interested necessarily in conquering and governing and controlling certain areas. True to their history, they were mostly interested in just raiding, taking whatever valuables and treasure, whatever booty they could find, particularly if it were silver or gold, and taking that back with them to Mongolia, rewarding their troops with that. So they weren't all that interested in setting up governments or that sort of thing. Most of the time, therefore, they left local governments in the hands of the local people. And as long as those cities and places and countries would pay tribute to the Mongols, they pretty well let them govern themselves. There are some exceptions. Well, following the death of Genghis Khan, the empire splits into four sections. We've seen that phenomenon before. We saw that, for instance, with Alexander the Great. After he dies, the Macedonian Empire splits into four separate sections. So after Khan dies, Genghis Khan, either one of his sons or his grandsons becomes a ruler. However, there is constant dispute over which one is the supreme ruler. And sometimes they fight each other, but often they've learned to just leave each other alone and just expand in their own directions. Conquest certainly continued, but they become four very separate regions. Those regions are the Golden Horde. That's North Asia and Eastern Europe. And in a minute I'll show you a map of these four, but the Golden Horde are the North Asia and Eastern Europe. The Kagata Khanate controls Central Asia, and they do that into the 1600s, so that's a long period of time. The Ilkhanate, which is basically the Middle East, lasts until the 1335 when the Ottoman Turks take over. And the Great Wan, which is in China and Southeast Asia, down into Vietnam, lasts until the 1370s when the Ming Dynasty takes over. So those are the four. The Golden Horde, the Kangika Khanate, the Ilkhanate, and the Great Wan that divide up Genghis Khan's empire. So here's a map of the four. This is the Wan, basically now what we think about as China and Southeast Asia. This is the Golden Horde up here. This is the Ilkhanate, and this is the Kagat Khanate. So these four areas all become known in history as the Mongolian Empire, but in a sense there's really four of them. And as you can see, they stretch from the Pacific Ocean all the way into Eastern Europe, places in Poland, the Ukraine, Russia, are all under their control. And this is why the Mongolian Empire is the largest contiguous land empire that the world has ever seen. They also have significant influence in northern India, both in this area as well as here. These folks are known as the Mughals, and they are in charge of India in that northern area. Oh, there you go. So the areas of northern India, the Mughals, descendants of the Mongols, rule in that area, and that is a very significant part of their politics and their conquest until 1600. These are the legacy empires, those that follow the four that I mentioned. Tamerlane is a name you should know. He is a significant figure in Islamic history as well as world history. He rules from 1370 until 1405. He's based out of Central Asia, basically what we think of today as Turkmenistan and Afghanistan. He is very solidly Islamic. Most of the time, the Mongols allowed people to retain whatever religions they want, and often they, as a matter of fact, supported the different religions. I think that Genghis Khan himself had Buddhist monasteries built, Buddhist temples built, Islamic mosques built, and Christian churches built in places where he ruled. They allowed folks to worship whomever they wanted. Tamerlane and others were a resurgent Islamic group, and they reconquered much of that Central Asian area that the Mongols had held, and spread Islam back there to northern India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, all the stands, and Tamerlane had influence all the way into the Middle East. And so that once more becomes solidly Islamic. Finally, the Ming Dynasty in China follows the Yuan Mongol Dynasty, and they are one of the more significant Chinese dynasties from 1370 to 1644. They show, the Ming Dynasty shows a time of really a tremendous cultural advancement and political stability. And as I mentioned, the Ottoman Empire, as we mentioned in the last session, becomes the empire that takes over after the Mongols are basically absorbed into the local culture in Asia Minor, and then later into the Balkans and into Eastern Europe. I mentioned Tamerlane. This is the area that he controls. So you can see here is Asia Minor. So much of the Caucasus region, Central Asia, Afghanistan, down to the Persian Gulf. Just a huge amount of area, which means, among other things, that he also has control primarily of the Silk Routes, which run generally either around the Caspian to the north or to the south and come out here in Asia Minor. So he becomes very, very wealthy and a very significant historic figure in those in that time period. We'll spend just a second talking about the importance of the Mongol invasion in to the development of Russia. As I said, prior to the Mongols, Kiev is the center of the Rus people. They have dominance in that area, Ukraine, Belarus today, and into the Ural Mountains to some extent. When the Mongols come, particularly the Golden Horde comes, they basically overwhelm Kiev, and Kiev is forced to move to Moscow, as a center of the Rus people, to escape being under the domination of the Mongols. But the Mongols, under the Golden Horde, are mostly in charge of what goes on in the Russian lands. And this is around in the middle of the 14th century, so 1350 to 1400, and they set a series of events in motion that determine the way Russian history is going to unfold in significant ways. I thought this quote was worth putting in by Dustin Hennessy. And let me just read it for you. Russian and the Mongols. Russian. As the evidence stands, the effects of the Mongol invasion were many, spread across the political, social, and religious facets of Russia. While some of those effects, such as the growth of the Orthodox Church, generally had a relatively positive effect on the lands of the Rus, other results, such as the loss of the Vetch system and the centralization of power, assisted in halting the spread of traditional democracy and self-government for the various principalities. Let me pause there and just unpack that a little bit. Prior to the coming of the Mongols, much of Russian life was decided by the locals. They had something called the Vetch system, where locals would vote for representatives who in turn would make their decisions. Just the building blocks of democracy. And Russia was on its way to becoming a democracy in significant ways. When the Mongols came, they did interfere and replace that with their own authoritarian system. They put leaders in charge who were more or less local dictators, and they decided how the people would live, and the people did not decide for themselves. So that's what he means by the loss of the vet system. He talks about the rise of the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox Church is an expression of the Eastern part wing of Christianity coming out of Constantinople, and it becomes the really only stable force left in the lands of the Rus once the Mongols come. The economy falls apart, the leadership falls apart, the political systems fall apart, but the church, again, because the Mongols are pretty tolerant religiously, the church becomes the center institution of Russian, what we can now call Russian culture. And that is going to hold true all the way, at least until the Russian Revolution, and still in many respects significant today. So that's what this Dustin is referring to. We'll pick it up here. From the influences on the language and the form of government, the very impacts of the Mongol invasion are still evident today. Perhaps given the chance to experience the Renaissance, as did other Western European cultures. So because the Golden Horde is there, the Russian people did not experience the European Renaissance the same way that Italy and Germany and France and England do. And that changes the entire view of politics, of economics, of art, of literature, of really the meaning of being human, the dignity and freedom that human beings should be given. They become the real seeds of a Western democracy and Western culture. So Russia doesn't experience this because the Mongols are in charge. That's what this gentleman is saying. Perhaps given the chance to experience the Renaissance, as did the other Western European cultures, the political, religious, and social thought of Russia would greatly differ from that of the reality of today. The Russians, though through the control of the Mongols, who had adopted many ideas of government and economics from the Chinese, that is a very authoritarian, very one person at the head, at the top, following the Confucian, the model of Confucianism, where the head of the father, the head of the household is the father and has complete, utter, only authority. So the emperor is head of the nation and is the only one who has any say about anything, actually. So from that Chinese, became perhaps a more Asiatic nation in terms of government, while the deep Christian roots of the Russians established and helped maintain a link with Europe. The Orthodox Church, as a Christian church, is the really one cultural link that remains between the Russian people and the rest of Europe. It was the Mongol invasion, which perhaps more than any other historical event, helped to determine the course of the development that Russian culture, political geography, history, and national identity would take. And that's really significant. The Russian people now, I mean, Russia stretches all the way through Siberia, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. That would not have happened without the Mongols. They would have stayed separate cultures, separate countries, but the notion that they could be one unified people really got its start from the Mongols and the Golden Horde. This is just a map of the Golden Horde and how significant they are. They don't really get as far as Moscow, but they get very close to it, and they control really the wealthy regions of Russia, the grain-bearing regions, as well as the silk trade that comes through from China. And here is their capital, the Mongol capital in Sari. So let me just reflect a little bit on the lasting significance of the Mongol invasion. As mentioned, they were the largest contiguous land empire in history. One of the things that they love to become wealthy, and they love portable wealth. They love gold and silver, something they could put on their horses and carry with them. And for that reason, they loved the money they could make on the trade. And it was incredibly important to them to keep the silk routes open, the land routes between eastern China and Europe. During the Mongol time, the goal was Genghis Khan said that he wanted a woman alone with just her purse to be able to travel safely from one end of the Mongol Empire to the other. No fear of being robbed, no fear of being exploited, no fear of being attacked. And that was pretty, for the most part, true. And so trade during this period of time between East and West tremendously flourishes. This is, by the way, later on, Kublai Khan is one of the Yuan emperors, the first of the Yuan emperors there in China. He's a grandson of Genghis Khan, and it's during his rule in China that Marco Polo, famous figure in Western history, Marco Polo spends his time in China, documents much of the Silk Route and what life was like. It really was the publication of his diaries and of his reflection that linked the East and the West, not just among a few of the great traders, but in the popular imagination. Marco Polo's Travels was a bestseller of his day, and his story circulated widely through Europe. That's how the average person, or even the kings, began to know about who people called, whom they called Cathay. China was called Cathay and from Europe, who these people were and what they were like. That's really very late in the Silk Road history, story, Marco Polo. It had been in business for 800-900 years already. So it isn't like Marco Polo opened trade between the East and the West. That's not true at all. But he did make it popularly known. The wealth of China and Europe go back and forth, and both become tremendously wealthy. And the Italian city-states, particularly Venice and Genoa, on the Adriatic Sea, the eastern coast of Italy, become huge commercial centers in the West, and they become hugely important politically. Venice and Genoa begin to call the shots in many respects for the next few hundred years because they have so much wealth and so much power through this trade with China. As I mentioned, they were religiously tolerant, and that has to be said within boundaries because later Tamerlane and the like insist on an Islamic life and not other religions, but they were, for the most part, religiously tolerant. They were central to the exchange of technologies between the East and the West. Cannot be demonstrated historically, but many suspect at this period of time, this is when gunpowder from China makes it to Europe. This is when paper and the production of paper, the production of books, which had been going on for hundreds of years with block printing, in China, makes its way to Europe. This becomes a very important time in which other technological improvements begin to happen, particularly in mathematics, in astronomy, in culture, in weaving, in production of cloth, in the minting of coins. All of that gets a huge boost during this period of time because of the Mongol peace that's established. There's also an exchange of disease, particularly smallpox, and what becomes one of the central dynamics of medieval Europe, the coming of the Black Death or bubonic plague, likely originates in the southern, southeast China, maybe northern Vietnam area. It devastates much of that area as well. It's not that people were immune from it, but then is spread through the caravans, through the Silk Route, and makes its way to Europe. So that in the 14th century, the story of 14th century Europe is in many respects the story of dealing with the plague. the plague resurfaces time and time and time again, and changes life. Smallpox as well. And smallpox will become central to the story of when Europeans come to North and South America, and the devastation that smallpox and cholera, typhoid, wreak on the native populations in the Americas. And as mentioned, one of the things that gets into our system is that advancement should not be based on one's family connections, cronyism, or the like, but should be based on merit. Some folks take that more seriously than others, I think. Now, we'll talk about some lasting significance of the Mongol invasion. It really helped competing powers in Europe, and there were many. England and France, we've talked about, are always at each other's throats. The Italian cities are often in conflict with others. It really helped them to unite against sort of a common enemy. That's particularly true when you get up into the Germanic people and the Slavic people in Poland and Prussia and Eastern Germany. They have to unite to have fighting forces against the Golden Horde in particular. And many alliances are built in Europe at this time to help ward off the Mongols. The Mongols are sort of the quintessential scary man. If you wanted to scare your children for some unknown reason, you would tell them stories that the Mongols are going to get you. They were the bad guys in Eastern Europe. And with some warrant, they were indeed often ruthless. They created their empire ruled by a common law, and that is we haven't seen that phenomenon much since Alexander the Great ruled his with a common notion of the polis and the Greek citizen, the notion of citizenship. But here, Genghis Khan promotes a law called the Yasa, it really began just as a series of rules about how you live a nomadic life and how you treat each other. But Genghis Khan expands that to cover many other areas of life. And the Yasa law becomes the fundamental blueprint of how the entire Mongolian Empire is supposed to treat each other and its citizens. They also establish a sort of a pony express for their mail system, such that within 10 days or so, a message from the Pacific Ocean could reach all the way into Europe. Maybe it was 2 weeks rather than 10 days, but that's a tremendously short period of time if you consider it being carried all on horseback. But of course, the Mongols are expert horsemen, and they have relay stations. I think that I read somewhere that each courier was expected to ride 120 miles in a day. If you know anything about horses, that's kind of an unimaginable amount of miles for a single horseman to ride, but it's what they were expected to do, to cover 120 miles a day and pass on the important dispatches. That kind of mass communication becomes sort of the model of how it can be the West can talk to the East and the East can talk to the West and get messages through in a relatively short period of time. This final slide on the Mongol Empire is just to demonstrate that this is a map of the world, how large an area the Mongol Empire actually encompassed. Like I said, all the way from the Pacific Ocean. So we have Korea and South China and northern Vietnam, Siberia, all the way well into Poland, into Prussia, into Austria, into Eastern Europe. Influence way down into the Persian Gulf and northern India, well down into Southeast Asia. Truly, the 13th century belonged to the Mongols, and worldwide. really, they belong to the Mongols, and we often underappreciate how significant they were. Let's take a breath a moment. We'll change gears. Move away from the theme of the conflict and clash among nations, the conquest theme. Just to move into some awareness of what was going on religiously in the world at this period of time. And I've had to really cut that down. Can't talk about every culture, of course, or even very many, but I thought we would look at Buddhism and Confucianism, particularly as it comes out in China, and then talk about the Christian West and its conflict with Islam, primarily. So Buddhism in Asia. Buddhism is the religion that links virtually all of Asia, China, all the way down to Thailand and Southeast Asia. You'll remember early on in the course we talked about Buddhism as really being a reform movement of Hinduism, and it gets its start right around 500 BC. So it's had a 1,000-year history by the time our period even begins, around 1000 AD, focused on the teachings of of Gautama, otherwise known as Buddha. And the fundamental goal of the religion of Buddhism is for the individual, for the person to attain enlightenment, to understand what is real, what is true about himself and about the world and about God. Once one does that, one can enter into the state of nirvana, which is similar to the notion of a Christian heaven, but in Buddhism, one does not have to be reincarnated again. One doesn't have to leave. It's sort of the final state of blessedness. Well, during this period of time, on both the Silk Routes as well as the Spice Routes, remember we use Spice Routes to talk about the Sea Routes, Buddhism spreads really throughout Asia. Their Buddhist missionaries are aggressive. They spread their faith, they build monasteries, they build temples, they become involved in local politics and the welfare of people. They're really a life-shaping kind of religion as it moves. And while by the time we reach our time period, 1000 to 1500, there really are two primary forms of Buddhism that emerge. The Mahayana and the Theravada. The Theravada Buddhism is really found mostly in southern Asia, and often it's called Southern Buddhism. So today's countries of Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, Myanmar, Laos, the kind of Buddhism that's practiced there is Theravada. It's much more a traditional, linked back to the texts that came from northern India, the text of Buddhism, it retains as its primary goal, as I mentioned, the emphasis on the individual, the person, to seek enlightenment in order to enter into nirvana. should note that I mentioned that it's about the individual, the person. In Mahayana Buddhism, which is also called Northern Buddhism, that's primarily in Tibet, in China, Taiwan, Korea, Mongolia, parts of Southeast Asia, like Vietnam. And that is often, sometimes it's divided into Tibetan Buddhism as well, but we're just going to call it Northern Buddhism and lump it all together. No offense to those who might be Tibetan Buddhists. Mahayana Buddhism, similar to Southern Buddhism, has an emphasis on the person seeking enlightenment, but after that there's much more to embrace of both the historical and non-historical Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva are beings who themselves have reached the point of enlightenment, but rather than enter into Nirvana, they have made the choice to stay in this world, in this realm, and help others go through the path in order to become enlightened, to reach Nirvana. So they become sort of like mentors or guides. Yogas, for instance. They become the holy people who help you move through the various stages of life in order to reach Nirvana. And one of the things that Northern Buddhism was able to do was, in contrast to Southern Buddhism, which pretty kept a very limited notion of who could be a Bodhisattva, basically just a few historical figures that one could pray to and ask for intercession and help from, that's in Southern. In Northern Buddhism, they were able to embrace many of the local gods, maybe some of the local heroes, some of the people. It was a much more adaptable to local conditions. And in that way, by incorporating those older, former gods into their into Buddhism, they became much more attractive, particularly to the masses, to the local population. And throughout China, for instance, Buddhism is almost always primarily practiced by the local people, whereas Confucianism is going to be practiced primarily by the aristocracy. This is just a map to help us understand a little bit of the geographical separation between Northern and Southern Buddhism. So Southern Buddhism is more of this pinkish area down to Cambodia, and here you can see it's much more closely connected to India, whereas Northern Buddhism encompasses all of the China, Korea, Japan, even where it's known as Zen. It also in the Tibetan form is very important here throughout the Central Plains and Central Asia. So, that distinction between Northern and Southern Buddhism still is true today. Buddhism is practiced in distinctive ways. Not only are they different in how they view the goal of life and the Bodhisattva, the help that you can receive, they also differ some in some of their liturgical practices and a few other ways. So here again is just a restatement of the main difference. In the Southern, the goal is for the person to attain Nirvana by going on the path of enlightenment. For the North, the goal is not only for oneself, but also to help others reach Nirvana as well. And in that way, it's a bit more of a communal and a bit more of a compassionate kind of Buddhism. There is, in a sense, an eternal conflict between these two kinds. I don't need to describe that very much. It was true in the beginning, and it's still true today. The Northern and Southern kinds of Buddhism that's practiced, while they don't at the moment practice open warfare, they do have very significant differences of opinion among them. Just want to say a thing about Buddhism and Confucianism, particularly as that is true in China. There's an on-again, off-again struggle between these two religions for the heart and soul of China, particularly for leadership in their culture and in their politics. Confucianism is often associated with the aristocracy. As I mentioned earlier, central to the notion of Confucianism is that their father figure is unquestionably the authority, everything goes through the father figure. Everyone's job is to show great honor and respect to the father figure, and even whether alive or dead. There's a great worship of ancestors that goes on, because the ancestors are very significant intermediaries with whatever powers or gods there might be. Confucianism doesn't really define a divine being any more than Buddhism does, but it does recognize that there's something greater than just oneself or just humanity. And the way to touch that greatness, the way to be in communication with that greatness, is through the authority of the father. The political system of China throughout the imperial periods and the various dynasties often appeals to this Confucian model. Not just that the emperor is in charge, but also how, as he delegates his authority to others, the people are supposed to respond. The notion is that authority is just never to be challenged. Once the father figure has said this is it, that's it. And that sort of patriarchal notion of things sets the cultural religious ground for much of China, and still in some respects is true today. The aristocracy loved, of course, Confucianism for the most part. There are some exceptions where some of the nobility become Buddhists and promote Buddhism, and during some periods of time that's greater than others. But for the most part, Confucianism is the religion of choice, religion of decision for the aristocracy. One can understand why. It helps them establish their authority. So in some respect, Confucianism is the dominant religion, and often it's the official religion. For the most part, the religion of the people, up until the 19th, for the most part, the religion of the people is going to be Buddhism. Oh, I should mention, by the way, that Confucianism becomes sort of the intellectual, legal framework for thousands of years in China, and really until the 1930s, it's the way it views the world, the way it views administration, the way it views economy, the way it views leadership, are all central to the training of the civil service. And the civil servants in China basically ran everything that worked on the local level. I should mention, there were periods of times that Confucianism and Buddhism were in military conflict, times of persecution, particularly of Confucianism against Buddhism, times the Buddhist monasteries were burned and the like. This is not just a religious clash. It often was a political, economic clash. There were periods of times when Buddhism was a very favored religion in China, times particularly when the state supported the monasteries, gave them relief from all taxation and the like, gave them certain investment rules where wealthy people would put their money into a monastery and then they wouldn't have to pay taxes on it, kind of a tax shield, a tax dodge. This did not, of course, go over well with the rulers, and many monasteries are attacked and destroyed. Again, not primarily because of a religious conflict or a spiritual conflict, but more of an economic one. The moral of the story is, the lesson of the story is that whenever, throughout culture, whenever religion and politics become entangled, religion loses. It becomes corrupt, it becomes compromised, it cannot pursue a spiritual truth. It becomes a vessel of the state, and the state then controls it. It's just a warning to all of us as we think about how does our faith interact with whatever political system we might happen to be living under. I am profoundly grateful that early on, founders of in the United States, Jefferson and Madison in particular, but others saw the danger of a state church and saw the danger of mixing religion and politics. And as the Virginia House of Burgess said, there is a unbreakable, inseparable wall between church and state. That's to the church's great advantage. History teaches that over and over and over, not just about Christianity, but just about how religion and politics, religion and economics, religion and the world works. To have that great wall of separation is a profound blessing. The next section turns during this period of time to what's going on in the Christian church. So that's primarily a Western European story, and I think that we'll save that until the next time. So until our next session, God bless you, and we'll see you soon.